Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, if you really stop and think about it, we still in medicine are not curing many diseases, so cures remain elusive. However, there's been some developments in genetics in particular and some in laboratory medicine that have advanced us to the point where we're beginning to forget about curing and more focus on prevention. And if we can prevent diseases or decrease the likelihood of them occurring, that's pretty good too. So today we're going to be talking with the Blood Bank of Alaska, representatives of their organization and the American Diabetes Association, who are doing and involved in international studies that are trying to identify individuals at high risk of developing type 1 diabetes, and then using that information to at times introduce ideas about with patients to prevent or at least slow down the occurrence of the development of type 1 diabetes. We'll be talking about diabetes at length today, and I want to just throw up a warning. There is a difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes that is important. We are not addressing type 2 diabetes in any way, and we are not here today to talk about the specific treatment of type 1 diabetes. This is about some research efforts in Alaska to help identify people at risk. So with me today to do this discussion is Leah Holman. She's an RN working with the Blood Bank, who is helping direct their clinical research programs, and Dr. Norm Means, who is the medical and laboratory director of the Blood Bank. And also in the studio with me is Michelle Cassano. She is executive director of the American Diabetes Association, Anchorage. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And while I'm on the topic, if anybody has questions or comments during the day, let me give you a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We'll be here for the next hour at that number. Also, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And as always, our email address, line1, you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. All right, so let's get started with some basics. And I think what I'm going to do, Michelle, is ask you to tell us a little bit about the Diabetes Association first. And you said you're tagging along with the blood bank people who are doing the study. But tell us about the Diabetes Association.
Well, the American Diabetes Association is the leading national organization on diabetes. One of our biggest goals is research, taking rocks out of the road for people who are living. Our mission is to prevent, cure diabetes, and to help all people living with diabetes. That's type 1, type 2, gestational, the new type 1.5. I mean, we've got enough info for lots of shows. But today we'd like to focus on our collaborative efforts with the Blood Bank of Alaska and research for type 1.
Michelle brings up an interesting point. There's actually more than two types. Two is enough for a lot of people, but there are clearly multiple ways that our bodies will end up with a diabetic-like picture, we're learning. And that's true of a lot of chronic diseases like arthritis and asthma as well. So thanks for pointing that out. And I won't ask you to define all the different...
Not today.
Dr. Means, you want to tell us a little bit about the blood bank and what's going on there?
Well, you know, the Blood Bank of Alaska is... as many of you know, we're in the process of building a new center. And one of the questions that comes up, if you have a new center, what kind of services are you going to offer to the state? Because, I mean, nobody wants just to build a building. It's not good enough. And this is a good example of the new kind of the services, a new kind of value that the Blood Bank of Alaska is going to be putting back into the community as we get our new center. To the best of anybody's knowledge, the Blood Bank has never participated in a large multinational, multi-center trial, investigation trial like this. And so we're really very excited to be participating in this. We see this as a kind of a small step into a much larger world. So we started this several months ago and been just very happy to have this opportunity and to take over here in Alaska, where previously the study was being managed by an out-of-state organization. It's nice to be able to bring this home here to Alaska.
Okay. Michelle or Norm, which one of you want to tell us about diabetes in general? What do we mean by the term diabetes?
Well, really, diabetes is the inability of your body to metabolize the calories it consumes. Everything we eat, be it carbs or glutens or candy or beverages, all turns to glucose chemically. And so your pancreas releases insulin, and then your little dots on your cells, this is my Disneyland version of diabetes, allows that sugar with the insulin to become energy in your cells. So that's why some of the symptoms of diabetes are lethargy, tiredness, inability to fight infections. And if you have undiagnosed diabetes, you're essentially wasting away or starving to death.
So with diabetes, we have the inability to take at least the energy in the form of glucose for the primary purpose of using it. And there's multiple ways that may happen. So that two big definitions are kinds of diabetes, type 1 and type 2.
Yeah, and the difference between the two is really, I think, is absolutely fundamentally important, because they really are not the same disease, and they have a common pathway in that they both lead to high blood sugars, but they're very, very different diseases. In type 2 diabetes, which is sometimes called adult onset diabetes, although that's also a bit of a misnomer, because we can have people very young develop this. In these people, their body becomes resistant to insulin, in that their cells do not respond appropriately to the amount of insulin present in the body. And so since insulin tends to drive blood sugars down, if you don't respond appropriately to it, then your blood sugars will rise. These people, over time, their pancreas will attempt to make more and more insulin to try to compensate and keep up, but eventually you get a burnout phenomenon where these people then don't make enough insulin at all, or they cease to make insulin late in the disease. We're interested here with the TrialNet study to study type 1 diabetes, and this has been historically called juvenile diabetes or juvenile onset diabetes, but again, another misnomer, because it can happen later in life as well. And these people maintain a normal or even heightened sensitivity to insulin, but their pancreas simply fails to make enough insulin, or even make any insulin at all. And that usually happens in a stepwise progression, where you get a little bit too little insulin, and your insulin production drops off until eventually you make no insulin at all. These people are extremely sensitive to insulin and can be managed oftentimes with very tiny amounts, whereas people with type 2 diabetes require, in some cases, huge amounts of insulin to overcome the resistance that their cells have developed.
All right, so let me make sure our listeners have this just as a basic fundamental understanding. So type 2 diabetes is a problem not with the organ that makes the insulin, the pancreas. It's with the ability of the glucose to get into the cells. There's something blocking insulin's ability to help that glucose get out of the bloodstream into the cells, whereas type 1 diabetes is loss of that insulin chemical from the switch being made in the pancreas. And I don't know if you use the term or not, that's more of what we call an autoimmune disease. Is that true?
We think so, and that's in fact what TrialNet is designed to try to puzzle out here. We do know that there appears to be a genetic component to some type 1 diabetics, and I think there's probably a genetic component to some type 2 diabetics as well. TrialNet is designed to look at not only the genetic risk factor, but also try to identify those people who early on in their illness will develop one or more of these autoantibodies, that is to say, antibodies the body makes which attack the body itself. Try to determine, we've identified through the studies, identified certain autoantibodies that appear to put someone at greater risk of developing type 1. And so the idea here is to screen people for these antibodies and determine, as you follow them over time, what their risk is of developing diabetes. And also, since we know that the more of these autoantibodies that you get, the greater your risk is, also to counsel people and to follow them along, so that we can detect the signs of incipient symptomatic diabetes earlier. I mean, the last thing you want is, unfortunately, a lot of type 1 diabetes presents to the emergency room, someone who is literally critically ill and is, on death's doorstep due to development of some of the very severe complications of diabetes, such as diabetic ketoacidosis. It'd be nice to be able to identify who those people are early so that they don't get so sick, and then maybe we could even save some lives by preventing people from getting to that step.
Let's ferret out this idea of autoimmunity a little bit more. I'm trying to put my mind in the myself in the mind of listeners out there, and I'm going to do my best at this and then ask you guys to tell or help me straighten it out. But autoimmunity is basically our immune system is geared up to protect us from foreign substances. Anything that's outside of our body, including other humans, our body reacts to. And for reasons that are not clear, sometimes our own immune system turns on itself. And so it'll make a chemical or turn the white blood cells into a situation where they may attack our cartilage and cause arthritis, or they may attack certain parts of our nervous system and cause certain nervous disorders. And in this situation, it appears the body has, for reasons that we're going to maybe talk about a little bit more here in a second, have developed antibodies or proteins that are telling it to destroy the islet cells, I believe it is, of the pancreas. Is that where these autoantibodies, for the most part, are working? So they're destroying the cells that are making insulin in the pancreas.
Destroying the beta cells.
Yeah. So the beta cells are the kind of cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas. So the pancreas is an organ sitting in the middle of your abdomen, and that's where insulin comes from. And as those things and white blood cells get turned on, they're destroyed. Eventually, there is lack of production because the organ is no longer functional. So why does that happen?
Well, I think that's what we're trying to sort out with TrialNet.
That's what the study's about.
So the idea is maybe something environmentally triggers it. Maybe people have a genetic predisposition to various autoimmune diseases. Thyroid disease is another one that sometimes is autoimmune.
There's also been a great deal of thought that, particularly in children, that there is a viral trigger.
Right. Right.
That, you know, often when we had that big measles outbreak in Anchorage about 8 years ago, about 10 months afterwards, we saw a significant increase in the number of youngsters diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So we're all about vaccines and avoiding any kind of viral
illness. The theory there is in lupus, thyroid disease, certain neurologic. So a lot of these diseases we know of are autoimmune. And so what you're saying is that the idea is one environmental trigger could be certain infections, and the body's attempt to control that infection makes antibodies or white cells go after our own tissues for one reason or the other. And certainly that's been shown in experimental animals. The kinds of studies you need to do in humans is unethical, unfortunately. So we can't do that. We have to refer or deduce that from what we're seeing in other animals. So type 1 diabetes is pretty certainly an autoimmune phenomenon. Type 2 diabetes is not, for the most part. So again, that's why we're talking about type 1 diabetes. What do we know about type 1 diabetes? You've already implied that it's often had been called juvenile, so it implies it's used to be, at least, more common in younger onset. People have a younger age when they get it. Is that generally still the case?
I think it's generally still the case, but as we, as more is learned about this illness, we find out that people of all ages can come down with, either type. There have been, I've had a patient as young as 10 years old who came down with so-called adult onset or type 2 diabetes. And I've seen people, patients of mine in the past who've come down with type 1 diabetes in their 40s. Mm-hmm. So, there's a professor of mine back in my residency training was always fond of saying that diseases don't read textbooks, and so they don't know what they're supposed to look like. And so that's, I think, good advice whenever you're looking at any of these diseases.
How about other populations? We have a native population as well as a Caucasian population. We have a pretty big mixture from across the world up here now with lots of other nationalities. Is there increased risk under certain populations that have a higher risk is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you mentioned the native population, and that's one of the ways that the Blood Bank of Alaska is, I think, well positioned, because there is a lot of the Alaska Native population has for many conditions is not well understood. The genetics of that population are obviously different than populations elsewhere, and so when people ask questions like that, we simply don't know. And so if we can, we would love to have people of a native ancestry come in for this testing, because that sort of information can then be used to build, information so that we can provide that information back to the native groups and give them the information they need to keep themselves and members of their groups healthy.
So one benefit of what I hear you saying, of what we're talking about today, is it would increase the likelihood of understanding better not only how type 1 diabetes develops, but also whether there might be some genetic predispositions based on certain genetic backgrounds.
Yeah, and if some groups are more likely to have problems than others.
And most of the real disparities we see are with type 2. However, when I worked in Nome in 1978 to 1981, we stocked no insulin at Norton Sound Hospital in Nome. And so we just treated no type 1 mm-hmm. diabetes and very little type 2. So now here I am with a career in diabetes 30 years later, mm-hmm. and we're seeing an enormous amount. So until recently, the native population percentages have been pretty consistent with Caucasian. However, their rates are rising. And as particularly the Anchorage population becomes more and more diverse, with everyone from Hmongs to Nepalese to Latinos to African Americans, we're seeing a lot of that. But a lot of that really is focused on type 2 and probably not on the agenda for today.
Well, there's an interesting corollary. I was reading in, and we've known about this for a while. I think many people out there will be familiar with the hygiene hypothesis for certain kinds of diseases. For instance, one study that was done very well in Great Britain was they were looking at people of Southeast Asian origin. And, the British are very, perhaps it's a bit of a public mania about peanut allergies in children. And, peanuts are not a large component of the British diet, whereas the people coming out of Southeast Asia had a large part of their diet was based on peanuts. And in fact, children were exposed to peanuts very early in life, even as early as 6 months or around that time period where peanuts were introduced into their diet. What they found was that people coming into Great Britain, immigrating from Southeast Asia, Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, those people had essentially no risk of having peanut allergies. And then they found is that when they looked at those people who, as they had children, they went into the first, the second, the third generation, that the longer the people were there, even though they were marrying within their own racial group, the rate of peanut allergy after, I think, three generations in was the same as the rest of Great Britain, mm-hmm. as peanuts, and the hypothesis where peanuts were being excluded from the diet. There was also an interesting study that's being done in Finland. And if you know your history, go back to the Second World War, the Russians invaded part of Finland and cut the province of Karelia essentially in half. And so you have a population who is genetically Finnish, half of whom live on one side of the Russian border, the former Soviet Union border, and the other half is, of course, in Finland. And what they found out was that, I think, and I'm trying to remember the number, but there's like a 40 to 60-fold higher rate of type 1 diabetes in the Finnish population, the very clean, hygienic population, compared to the people who are genetically identical on the Russian side of that border. On the Russian side of the border, however, they suffered from poor medical care, poor hygiene and sanitation. So they had a lot higher incidence of other kinds of diseases that we might tend to associate with the third world that weren't being seen in Finland. So, they've done studies like that in Germany, comparing East and West Germany and all that. So there's some thinking that, we may be, as strange as it may sound to hear a physician say this, we may be a little too clean for our own good.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's something about Western civilization increases allergies and not just autoimmune diseases, but some chronic diseases. Crohn's disease is one in particular that has increased. So is the incidence of type 1 diabetes increasing?
No.
Yes, and it's increasing faster in the 1 to 5-year-olds.
Really? And so younger individuals are the rate of new cases per population number
is going up. Uh-huh. Yes. One of the reasons for doing the TrialNet study is a natural history study. Its precursors were the diabetic prevention study and a study that was done in Europe, and they were both clinical studies. They found the indication of the genetic links, but they didn't have enough natural history information to go along with it. So part of what we're doing with this study with the TrialNet is collecting that ethnicity and demographic to make a broader base on it and to really try and link that to the genetics.
Ages, sexes, nationality.
Age, sex, nationality, ethnicity, race.
Let me remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. We're talking about the involvement of the Blood Bank of Alaska in an international group of studies looking at the identification of people at risk for type 1 diabetes. And also further studies are being done, although we'll ask again in a minute, but I don't think the blood bank here is being involved, but people identified by the blood bank in their studies are being given some opportunity to perhaps get into studies that may affect the later development of diabetes, and we'll talk about that at some length. But if you've got questions or comments, you can reach us directly in Anchorage at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as always, you can email at line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, so maybe that's enough about just the basic information about diabetes and autoimmunity and the difference between type 1 and type 2. So let's get back to this TrialNet study, and maybe one of you all tell me what's the TrialNet study. It's actually more than one study, as I've already implied, but and then what you guys are doing specifically here.
TrialNet's a multinational. It's an international study. It involves 18 clinical centers, centers in Finland, Great Britain, Austria, Germany, Finland, Australia, United States, Canada, and then underneath those centers or feeding into them, which is what we are at the blood bank, are the affiliate screening centers. There's about 184 of us right now. So we're looking at getting a very large population cross kind of.
Mm-hmm. And who are you looking for?
We are looking for relatives of type 1 diabetics. So for first degree relative, that's like a father, brothers, our father, daughter, sister, brother, mother. Between the ages of 1 and 45. And second-degree relatives between the ages of 1 and 20, and that would be grandparents, half-siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins with type 1 diabetes.
So if listeners are out there and they have very close relatives with type 1 diabetes and they are interested in knowing more, they may not get all their questions answered in this program, what do they do?
They can call me at 222-5615. At the blood bank, or you can email me at trialnet@bbak.org.
Okay. Is there any cost to being involved?
There is no cost to this study. And it's totally free and to the recipients or the participants. And should they become eligible for one of the other studies, there's no cost associated with those either.
Okay. All right. I think what I'm going to do at this point is go ahead and take a short break. And then I want to remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection, and we're originating from KSKA Anchorage. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us directly at 550-8433. Our email is at line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll take a short break here, and then we're going to rejoin my guests, Michelle Cassano, Leah Holman, and Dr. Norm Means. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing the Blood Bank of Alaska's participation in an international study that aims to help identify individuals at high risk of developing type 1 diabetes. We have, up to this point, spent a lot of most of the program trying to understand the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes, what we mean by autoimmunity, which is the mechanism by which type 1 diabetes occurs and is different than type 2. So this is all about type 1 diabetes. Some of these individuals who may be identified by the study that the blood bank's involved in may have access, if they desire, to some prevention studies that are a follow-up to that. My guests are Dr. Norman Means. He's the medical and laboratory director for the Blood Bank of Alaska, Leah Holman, who's with the Blood Bank of Alaska and running their clinical research programs, and Michelle Cassano, who is the executive director of the American Diabetes Association, Anchorage. So we've just got through talking about the study and how it's who's involved and who you're looking for, and you're basically, to simplify things, you're looking for individuals between 1 and 45 who have very close relatives with diabetes, type 1 diabetes. And if you have not heard the beginning of the program and you want to know more, or you have and you want to get involved or learn more, you can go to trialnet@bbak.org, trialnet, all one word, at bbak.org, or call Leah at 222-5615. All right, Leah?
Yes, it is.
All righty. Let's go ahead. We have a caller on the air. Let's see what her question is. Marge, you with us?
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I'm curious because I have a family history of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes in both sides of my family. My parents, my grandparents, I don't know about my three brothers, but I was a hypoglycemic from the age of 12 until about 42, and then I became a type 2 diabetic. And I have a cousin who is a type 1 diabetic, and a couple of years ago they did a pancreatic surgery on him, and while he was on the operating table, when they attached the new pancreas to his blood vessels and opened it up, he went from being a type 1 diabetic, insulin dependent, to being a non-diabetic, no problems at all, before he ever woke up from surgery.
Okay. All right, so it sounds to me like you got a number of questions, and I'm going to try to answer what I can, and then we'll see if anybody else here wants to join in. There is absolutely no reason somebody can't have both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, as far as I know. They're different diseases completely. It's no different than somebody having rheumatoid arthritis and thyroid disease, or, you know, ulcers and thyroid disease. So you could have both. Not very common. I'm not sure I've ever seen anybody with that unfortunate occurrence, but it's possible. And so certainly within families, you can have both things happen, both illnesses happen. Now, the other issue you brought up is, it sounds like your nephew or one of
my
your
cousin.
Your cousin. It sounds like you said he had a new pancreas added, and whether that was probably a mechanical pancreas. They've been doing some things with injection of...
I'm not sure if it was a transplant or if it was a mechanical one.
Right. Well, there's several things that have been tried. They've used just insulin, injection of insulin, producing cells from the pancreas. None of us here, I don't think, are probably expert enough to answer this specifically, although I'll ask the others to comment. But certainly there's no reason why, if that was done, and it would have to be a pretty experimental. This is not anything that's being done regularly, but if it was successful, then the purpose was to make him no longer diabetic and type 1 diabetic, and it sounds like that was successful for him. But that is, as far as I know, not a available, routine, approved, safe, and effective treatment anywhere in the United States at this point. And I'm getting all kinds of answers from the same. So that was some unusual situation, but he may have been involved in a study.
A research study, perhaps.
Yeah. Perhaps, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, at this point, they were doing kidney pancreas transplants, and they are doing some solely pancreas transplants, but they're all in the research realm. And islet cell transplants, of course, that's the one we're all really excited about.
Well, Marge, is your cousin here in Alaska by any chance?
No, actually, he's in Michigan.
Oh, I'm about to say, if you have any family in Alaska that's related to your cousin, we'd love to hear from them.
All right. Thanks for your call, Marge.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, we got another call. Why don't we go ahead and take Robin? Robin, what can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a son with type 1 diabetes, and I have another son who does not have diabetes. So I am interested in the trial, and I was just wondering what tests are performed and how would this help my other son?
But great questions, and hang on, and we will give you the answer. Why don't we go ahead?
Okay, so that's exactly the type of participant we're looking for this screening process. The advantage, what the screening entails is it's a short demographic form that I described earlier. You know, it talks about family, who's related, what the onset was, the age of the onset of diabetes in the relative, and then we do an informed consent because this is a research study, and for children between 7 and 11 and 11 to 17, there's even an assent form for them, which isn't, you know, the legal informed consent that the parent has to sign, but it also lets the younger participants in the study actually know what's going on with the study, what the expectations are, what they can expect from it. And then we do a very small blood draw. I take about a tablespoon of blood, just, you know, like when you go to the doctor's office and you get a blood sample. We ship that sample off to University of Florida, which is the screening site for doing the antibodies, and they test for three specific insulin autoantibodies. Depending on what the results of that are, 95% of the participants or the people that we screen come back negative. But should there be a combination of positives on those autoantibodies, there's further screening and monitoring visits that are involved.
And so would this somehow be able to kind of foresee things that are happening and hopefully prevent, like, what we dealt with, the horrible quick onset?
Right.
That's the part of the idea of this, is if we do early identification, usually what happens, like Dr. Mean said, is what we see presenting for diabetics are people in crisis in the emergency room. They're already in ketoacidosis, really, really sick, severe weight loss, that kind of thing that's going on with them. Earlier identification, you don't get into the complications as badly with that. This is a significant issue worldwide. I mean, we spend over $100 billion annually on treating diabetes and its complications across the world. So the advantage there is the early identification. And depending on what comes back from those screens, the possibility of being of participating in one of the other studies to look at further delaying onset. And there's risk factors associated that the risk is a little bit different depending on which antibodies and what combination of antibodies are positive.
So they actually have a plan of if a person does come out positive to actually delay it?
There are studies that are being looked at to see if they can prevent it. And
And if the antibodies are there, if they get a positive antibody on one of these three, it's about a 3% average risk over 5 years that's greater than the general population for developing type 1.
Well, I'll definitely check out the website and talk to my son about it. He's 17 and tends to faint when he has blood drawn, but hopefully I can convince him to do it.
I'm really good. I've drawn a lot of kids.
And is this going on right now?
It is going on right now.
Okay. All right. I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, and listen, I'm about to ask two more important questions that you might want to know the answers to. Okay. So we said that most people have a negative test.
Yes.
Of the people who have a negative test, what percentage of them go on to develop type 1 diabetes? So how accurate is the test on if it's negative? You guys know off the top of your head. And I know that's kind of be a difficult, but the next question is what if they're positive? And that's another way to look at this. I'm going to ask Dr. Means about that one here.
Well, if they have a positive test, really we're looking at the more antibodies that we have, the bigger the risk. We know that if you have two or more of the antibodies. We do initial screening for three antibodies, and if someone's positive for one or more of those, we'll bring them back and test them for additional two antibodies. But if they have two or more of those autoantibodies, then they have a five-year risk of about one-third of coming down with type 1 diabetes. So it's about 32% over a five-year period. So,
okay, so one in three people who have more than two antibodies are going to develop diabetes within 5 years.
Correct, if they have the antibody. Now, only about 5% of people will show up with at least one antibody. And if you only have one antibody, the risk is much, much lower.
Okay, all right.
So if I could translate that to a real family from Anchorage.
Sure.
So we had a family whose 8-year-old daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes through a collaboration with another lab at the time. They went and had the children screened. Middle son had no genetic marker. Youngest child did. They had an opportunity and the means to participate in a research study. So that youngest child did not develop type 1 diabetes for 9 years. And while he was in the study, he was taking very small amounts of insulin. It gave his family, it gave everyone a little time to adjust. It's always traumatic when a family member, a child, is diagnosed with a chronic, potentially life-threatening disease, but at least it gives them a little fair warning and a little chance to prepare, not only the family, but the children.
So, again, let me just clarify what you said. You had a family where they had three kids. One of them developed type 1 diabetes. The other two were tested. One of the kids had no antibodies and has to this date has not developed type 1.
Yes.
And the other one had one or two or more antibodies and elected to go on into a subsequent study, not the same study, but a different study.
A previous study.
Which was testing the ability to give oral insulin, not IV or injected, which is usually used. So it was this study was looking at oral insulin to see if we could delay the onset of diabetes. And it appears that it probably delayed the onset for a while.
Yes.
Okay.
But I guess, more than just the medical details, I'm looking at the social, economic, and family unit. Because as we all know, chronic disease is very difficult on families. So. Right. That's where the association is going to work with the Blood Bank of Alaska through our family link, our family programs, our summer camping program, where we have access to the population they're looking to test. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bring their services to the population and help refer the population to the Blood Bank.
Yeah, so from the American Diabetes Association, you'd like to see the Blood Bank doing this because now you have ready access to actually people who can go right into the study. They don't
right
have to have
the study,
blood
it
drawn.
It empowers people. In my career, people have always lamented as, what did research mean to Alaska?
Mm-hmm.
And how could people in Alaska participate in research studies? And we used to have to dig really hard to find a means for this. And so to us, this is truly a gift. Not only a gift, but being associated with the Blood Bank of Alaska, we're going to absolutely make sure that there are standards and that the testing is going to be done correctly and that there'll be adequate follow-up and education.
And I think, Michelle brings up an excellent point, and it really can't be overstated. And I know Dr. Woodard, as a physician, you know this as well, that most of the battle for a type 1 diabetic is really education. Educating the family, educating the patient, because it really is a massive lifestyle change, which, obtaining the medicine is only part of that. And it's really, getting insulin is really only a small part of that. It involves dietary education and, health screening and observation and getting the right health care. And, the old saying that forewarned is forearmed, I think that applies here very much. And so if someone comes in and participates in the study and we can identify perhaps some, unfortunately, we identify someone who's at high risk of developing developing this, then we can start that educational process earlier. The blood bank can refer people to their doc, to the pediatrician or the family physician. We can refer to the American Diabetes Association here in Anchorage, and we can start that education process early so that at such time, if someone actually does develop type 1 diabetes, and it's a much smoother transition, and we can catch it before they become critically ill, which is so important.
The other thing with the TrialNet study that's really impressive is the family support, because it's another resource for these families. It's challenging with kids going through the growth and development, as well as the physical changes, and dealing with a chronic illness, no matter what it is, you know, diabetes, asthma, any of those diseases are going to last you throughout your life. It's challenging as they're going through all the other changes in their life, and TrialNet has a excellent support system that it builds in, and it's a lot of peer-to-peer. Mm-hmm. Their website, just diabetestrialnet.org, has some great links on it. They have a YouTube channel that has actual participants that talk about the program and the extra studies that they're in. It's really, and their Facebook page is awesome, so they're great on social media as well.
I should just go ahead and mention, we did put up on our website, alaskapublic.org, if you go to that and find the Line 1 link to this program, you will see resources or links to the National TrialNet videos, the American Diabetes Association, and another link to just more information about type 1 diabetes, as well as the blood bank. So there's plenty of resources out there about this very important study. Another question I have about the study is, let's say you have a negative screening for the antibodies or a positive. It would seem like in this study, we want to know what happens to those people over time, so there has to be some follow-up of these individuals. How's that being done?
They're calling them screening or monitoring visits. For people that have two or more antibodies, it's a semi-annual screen, and again, it's a blood sample. It's another questionnaire. We go into more depth about diet. There's kind of a little diet journal that goes with it, a physical activity journal for like the previous week. And in addition, we do oral glucose tolerance testing, and check hemoglobin A1Cs. And then for the low risk, or even people that don't have the participants that sign up and get screened and are negative, they can come back annually until they're 18 mm-hmm. for annual screening. And even if they're negative, they may be involved in or asked to be part of a control group within one of the other studies.
Okay. So this information that you obtain locally then goes into an international database.
Yes.
And individuals are not identified, and there's always this issue about confidentiality. How is that addressed?
It's a blinded study from a from that database standpoint. Their participant IDs are assigned mm-hmm. to each sample. So during the TrialNet study specifically, those participant IDs are linked to the individual, but it goes back and forth between the site and the main center. Once the study's over, there is an option to either have your samples destroyed or to continue on as part of the blood bank, but they are all de-identified at the end of that at the end of the TrialNet study when it concludes. There'll be all that biobank will be de-identified.
Yeah, and I think that's important for the participants to understand, is that we have extremely high standards for privacy protection. And me personally, that's a huge issue in healthcare nowadays, and I'm sure many people out there feel the same way. Only the very highest standards are applied to the TrialNet study.
Michelle, I know you need to try to get away. You want to talk about anything else about the Diabetes Association you leave?
Well, always. I always love time for a commercial.
I had a feeling you might.
Yeah. Well, tomorrow is the American Diabetes Alert. It's our 21st anniversary of doing a nationwide public day of awareness. And tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 in Anchorage, people can join us at Westchester Lagoon. We're going to have barrel fires and physical activity. With this weather, I'm not sure if we're skating with the UAA Seawolves, but we're going to try. We're going to have kind of like a scavenger hunt that'll take you on a path of taking risk factors for diabetes and knowing what your score is. We're asking you to step out and take the test. So we're encouraging everyone to be a little active and to learn a little more about diabetes. And as much as this research is at no cost to the public, how many organizations do that is through our fundraising efforts. And a portion of our fundraising goes directly into research. So we will be celebrating our Grand Affair Gala this Saturday night at the Hotel Captain Cook. And once again, you can just go to diabetes.org or call the office at 272-1424. And we have a very broad base of educational and fundraising opportunities for people to volunteer and participate in. And as we are talking to parents out there who have children, our diabetes summer camp will take place from July 27th through August 1st at the beautiful Kenai Lake, the Camp Cave facility, with a complete medical staff. And we have scholarships and anything families need. We're there to help take those rocks out of the road and ultimately help prevent diabetes and get people in good health.
All right. Michelle, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you all. Good to see you.
Be careful.
Yeah, thank you.
What about risks? Are there any risks associated with the study? People might want to ask that question.
There are actually a couple. You know, it's a blood draw, so there's that risk and the fear of having the little needle and potential for bruising there at the site. Mm-hmm. The other one is, and one of the biggest challenges with this is that unknown versus the known, and some people really don't want to know that risk factor, so it can cause some anxiety. And that's probably one of the more common things that you hear is, I don't want to know because it's like a ticking time bomb. Right. And then the flip side of it is, I know I can prepare.
Yeah, that's something that Michelle didn't bring up. Michelle was very positive about the idea of early identification is important. But in this age of genetic testing, there are a number of problems. One, false positives, getting a test that suggests you're going to be at risk, but you never do, and false negatives. And people need to really understand these things. And when we're talking about things like mastectomies to prevent breast cancer, it gets pretty serious. And so there are some ethical issues, and it's very important for people to understand these. This seems to me a very, very well done, very well thought out kind of study, and I'm sure there's people who may not want to know about their risk of diabetes. I think I would want to know about my risk of diabetes with this and be even further interested, depending on the intervention style test, to try to see what we might do to delay or prevent the onset. So it seems interesting to me.
Well, you know, keep in mind, you mentioned about this being a well-done study. This is a very large study. There are over 200 centers now worldwide throughout the country and around the world that are participating in this. And, you know, this is perhaps the largest study of its type ongoing.
There's about 12,000 participants right now that have been screened. One of the things that came to mind when you were talking about that is just, and as Michelle was leaving and talking about the funding for the Diabetes Association. Diabetes Association is one of the sponsors of this study, as is the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation and several of the branches of the National Health Institute.
Another thought that comes up that people may have questions about is what impact might this have on somebody's insurability? You know, we hear about this constantly now. There's a lot of concern. So you have a positive test that says you have some risk for developing diabetes. Let's be specific. Are you guys aware of how that may affect insurability, costs of insurance, and so forth?
For some of the earlier information that's put out, and this is actually on the website, it does talk about that a little bit. This doesn't go to any insurance companies. Like I said, this is information that is kept under the HIPAA guidelines pretty much, and the purview of the informed consent for the TrialNet study. But with the Affordable Care Act, pre-existing conditions are kind of grandfathered into that.
Yeah. I guess we could argue, if I was a lawyer, this is not a pre-existing, you know.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a risk assessment. It's not a diagnosis.
Right.
It's risk,
okay.
And risk doesn't mean guarantee.
Right. So as far as we know, that's not an issue, really.
No.
It's potentially an issue. You know, what I haven't done is given a contact information. Again, we're talking about the Blood Bank of Alaska's participation in some international studies identifying individuals at higher than normal risk of developing type 1 diabetes. If you have questions or comments, we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left here. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you can call us toll free at 1-888-353-5752. What other issues have we not specifically addressed, do you think we need to come up with? Norm, you were asking about or suggesting if people that don't even have diabetes can participate in helping this. These are very expensive studies, and people don't appreciate that when you get thousands and thousands of people. But they give us the best information when you do these large studies. But one of the reasons they're not done very often is because of the cost.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't have, you know, unfortunately in this state, and we're working on it. I mean, I think people across the state are working on improving the, you know, we call the infrastructure of healthcare delivery in this state. And this brings up a good example of that. You know, if you don't have diabetes and nobody in your family has diabetes, but, you know, you want to help out, one way to do that is to support the Blood Bank of Alaska. As many of the listeners know, we are in the process of building a new center. That center has not yet been fully funded, and so we're actively engaged recruiting support from the community. And if you go to the Blood Bank of Alaska website, you'll find a link there that you can click on as a way to show your support. You can also support organizations such as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation and the American Diabetes Association. These people are doing outstanding work in our community to try to promote wellness and to help those people who unfortunately come down with these diseases. So there are many ways to help. Contact your senators and your representatives and tell them that you support the Blood Bank of Alaska and ask them to continue their already outstanding support of our organization. We certainly would appreciate any help that we can get from the community. And I know the community has been stepping up to the plate and has been supporting us 100% on all these activities.
How else are you trying to get the word out about testing? I mean, it seems like it'd be important for physicians as a group to be aware. I mean, they're seeing patients every day with patients who have type 1 diabetes, and the relatives of those individuals might be interested in this.
I have been around to several of the physicians' offices. I've been to the Providence's Children's Hospital Parent Support Group.
Mm-hmm.
We have been to, actually last week I was at the school nurses, Anchorage School Nurses Conference. We talked about it. I will be at the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation's walk on May 10th. And partnering with the other communities. So it's just getting around to the organizations and letting them know we're here.
Increasingly, many patients with type 1 diabetes are managed by just a handful of physicians nowadays. I guess you've kind of identified those in particular. I'm thinking of the pediatric endocrinologist and so forth here in town.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that, you know, if any physician out there has any questions, any mid-level provider, nurse practitioner, PA, has any questions about referring patients here to our study, they can call again 222-5615 and can speak to Leah, or if they want to speak to me about this, and Leah can certainly arrange for them to get in touch with me and we can have a conversation about this. But we would welcome referrals from any specialty, from any healthcare provider.
And we have there's a lot of information, like the participant handbook that it talks about, that talks about the study and what actually happens within it. Happy to provide those to the offices. Anybody that's interested in them, I can mail it out. I'm happy to deliver it.
And your contact number again is 222-5615.
Yes.
That's right. All right. So in our last couple of minutes here, I'd just like to kind of summarize again, maybe ask Leah, have you do that, or Norm, you're doing a study identifying people at high risk. Who are we looking for? How do they get in touch with you? What are the information that they're going to get from participating in this study?
Well, we are looking for close relatives of people that have been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, 1 to 45 years of age, brothers, mothers, fathers, sisters, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and they can give me a call, and I'm pretty open and flexible as far as the screening times and scheduling. And if somebody is from out of town, this is a big one, if they're out of town and not going to be in the Anchorage Bowl area, I can send testing kits out. We do have mobile blood drives and the Fairbanks Center. We can do screenings up there.
Okay. Thank you. Norm, any final thoughts?
I just wanted, I think it would be, I think, important to recognize the contributions that the state government has made here. Governor Parnell has been very supportive. This has been a high priority of his administration to support the construction of our new center. And we want to be certain to thank him for his efforts. The state legislature has just been fantastic in supporting us with this project as we continue forward. We'll be actually beginning construction of the building here in just the next couple of months. And the construction time is going to take us approximately a year and a half. So if people are driving by Alaska Regional Hospital across the road, across Airport Heights Road there, may have seen a big hole in the ground that's gradually been filled in with gravel. That's actually going to be the site of the new center. So we appreciate your support. We've been getting a tremendous amount of support from the community and from our government, and we want to thank everybody for that.
Okay. All right. My thanks to you, Dr. Means, and Leah, for taking the time to be with us, and also to Michelle Cazano, the executive director of the ADA, for taking the time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If the listeners would like to continue more with the conversation on this study, you can find the link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can get onto Facebook and continue that. Also at that website, you can get into our archives and listen to this program at any time you'd like to, or some previous ones. Next week, we're going to be back, and we're going to be talking about the health effects of secondhand smoke. And we haven't done this before, e-cigarettes. That's a hot one, and we need to know a little bit more about the health effects of that maneuver with Marge Stone King of the American Lung Association of Alaska, and also joining us will be Emily Ninon of the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. So you could tune in next Monday, March 31st at 2 p.m. to hear more about that. I also promised to mention, as a public service announcement, a public lecture by Dr. Tracy Woodruff. Dr. Woodruff is director of the University of California, San Francisco program on reproductive health and the environment. She's going to give a talk entitled Generations at Risk, Toxic Chemicals and Effects on Children, Reproductive Health, and Future Generations. Tomorrow night, at 7, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the UAA Fine Arts Building, room 150. You can call 222-7714 for more information. I want to say thanks to Monica Gokey for engineering today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.